morning, listeners. Welcome to this week's edition of Thursday in the Doghouse. I'm Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer. As always, we're here today to present a program that will help educate you, the dog-owning community, about all things dog. We spend a great deal of time on Thursday mornings talking about dogs' behaviors and why they do the things they do. We've had several discussions about canine body language and how to recognize when your dog is stressed or feeling uneasy about a situation. We've talked about the little dogs like Bichons, Chihuahuas, and Dachshunds, and about the special challenges little dogs can come up with. A few weeks ago, we even had an interview with a certified cat behavior consultant, and she helped us learn more about resolving litter box issues. We'll be doing another cat show again soon. This morning, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Michael Dim, a homeopathic veterinarian who practices in the South Jersey area. Dr. Dim is one of 250 veterinarians in the United States trained in classical veterinary homeopathy. He's a presidential scholar graduate from Cornell University with his VMD from the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Dim is an active member of the Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy and the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association. He also offers progressive integrative conventional veterinary medicine, including vaccine alternatives, as well as topical and oral pesticide options for dogs and cats. Dr. Dim and I will be discussing what he believes to be a severe overuse of vaccines on our pets. I can tell you that he's helped educate me on many things over the years and has opened my eyes to this subject and also about our pets' diet and nutrition. We'll be talking to Dr. Dim in just a moment. But please let me tell you what services I offer as a professional dog trainer in the South Jersey area. Is your dog always in the doghouse? Does he greet people by jumping all over them? Does she chew your shoes and steal your undies? Guess what? Your dog needs training. Hi, I'm Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer, and I train dogs using only positive-based methods. My services include private training right in your own home. I also offer group puppy kindergarten classes starting at 8 weeks of age and group classes for adolescent and adult dogs beginning at 5 months of age. All group classes are held at Dog Days Camp for Canines, 23 West Main Street, Marlton, New Jersey. For more information, please contact me at 609-280-9338 or on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Again, that's 609-280-9338 or on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Good morning, Dr. Dim. Thanks so much for joining us here in the doghouse this morning.
That's great being here, Rini.
Thank you very much. Can you briefly explain what the difference is between a holistic approach to medicine versus traditional approach to medicine?
Well, that's a great question that I get asked quite frequently by both veterinarians and animal guardians. There's a few aspects to that that I think will help the audience and perhaps open up for some of our further discussion. Traditional veterinary medicine kind of looks at our body when we're sick with certain symptoms, almost like we're sick in parts. And what I mean by that is almost like we're automobiles. If we have a skin problem or a digestive problem or a urinary issue or a behavioral issue, then it's just that part of the body that's sick. And, you know, those symptoms that are expressed are what an illness or disease is. Or it actually looks at things external to ourselves, such as germs and bacteria and viruses that cause disease and need to be eradicated by strong drugs and antibiotics. That's kind of the basic tenet of traditional veterinary medicine. And then what we do in traditional medicine is we use conventional drugs or surgeries to suppress symptoms of those local expressions. Holistic medicine, on the other hand, views the body as being ill as a whole, not in parts. It looks at different factors that potentially can affect the health of an individual, such as things that you put on or in the body, and you mentioned a few of those in your introduction, such as vaccinations, what we put in our body in terms of diet, what we put on our body in terms of their bodies, in terms of pesticides, and both for fleas and ticks, as well as heartworm medication. Holistic medicine attempts to use medicines, manipulations in some cases, homeopathic remedies, herbs, acupuncture needles, to assist the body in restoring health and balance as a whole, rather than just suppressing the local expression of a symptom, which is what we do in traditional medicine. And the goals of any holistic medicine, actually, is to make a patient, whether it's an animal or whether it's a person, less susceptible to future illness or disease. So in other words, healthier.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of, something that I think really kind of summarizes the difference. Traditional medicine also only looks at the symptoms that are present right in front of the doctor at that given moment in time. Often those symptoms are present in a crisis, you know, where we rush our animals off to the veterinarian. And again, we use drugs and surgeries to mask those acute symptoms, make them often go away quite quickly. You know, we want our animals to be comfortable.
Right.
But they rarely make the patient healthier or less susceptible to future symptom attacks or other illness elsewhere in the body, which is really what the goal of any holistic medicine it really does. So, mm-hmm. You know, traditional medicine considers early diagnostic testing, mammograms, colonoscopies, those kind of techniques as preventative medicine, whereas holistic medicine really looks at how do we, encourage health of the body through diet, through healthier living, not relying on drugs, chemicals, vaccines, that kind of thing.
Okay. This actually leads me to a question that formed as you were talking. So does it take a little bit longer for the holistic approach to take effect on the animal? It sounds to me like traditional medicine would be quicker. You would get more of a quick fix versus trying to make the entire body healthy.
That's a great question, too. Yeah, traditional medicine is going to, in a lot of circumstances, get quicker fix results. For example, probably everybody's heard of the allergic dog. I mean, that's probably the most common medical presentation we get other than wellness visits in our canine patients. And typically, a cortisone injection is used or oral prednisone to make the itching symptoms go away quite quickly. However, unfortunately, those drugs, like I said, what they do is they suppress the symptoms. And they have, not only do they suppress the symptoms, but they have long-term potential side effects. And given that the body is sick as a whole, what happens typically is that patient will become sicker on a deeper level at some later point in time. In other words, manifesting the same immune or allergic reaction at a deeper level in the patient. That's what we mean by the body being sick as a whole. So, yes, quicker fix, but, with usually a chronic healthcare process.
Okay. So is it a good thing to use both traditional medicine and holistic medicine together, or do you go with the approach that only holistic works best?
Well, the best answer to that would be each case should be looked at, and this is another aspect of holistic medicine, I should say, as an individual. There are some cases where an integrative approach does work. For example, I get calls every week from across the country in my holistic phone practice for clients that are trying to help their animals with very terminal or end-stage cancer. A lot of them are working with cancer specialists or oncologists. And in those cases, often a pure holistic or homeopathic approach, might not be the best solution for that animal. And in those cases, that's where they're using me as kind of their holistic consultant to help with, nutrients and supplements and in an integrative approach help them if they're doing chemotherapy, whereas their conventional veterinarians and oncologists have very little knowledge or training in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other cases, of course, where the drugs, the medicines, the surgeries are making the animals sicker and they're getting chronically more ill and clients don't like that. And so they have to abandon that to a more pure holistic approach. So again, it would depend really on the individual case, the individual history.
Okay, this is really very interesting. You stated that over the past 40 years, there's been a tremendous increase in chronic ill health in our pets that was very rare in the 1960s. So what do you think has caused this increase?
Well, I kind of touched on some of it in my opening remarks about the differences between traditional and holistic medicine. Over the past decades, we've taken that quick fix approach. We've, for example, injected multiple viruses into patients year after year after year without regard whether they need them or not. And we've done this over some 20, 25 generations of dogs and cats. We've fed them nutrient-poor processed commercial foods over those generations. We've used drugs to suppress symptoms and make them go deeper in the body, thus having unhealthier parents who then breed on to the next generation. In fact, some of these things have actually, like, certainly over-vaccination, sometimes it's caused genetic changes in the DNA so that the next generations are actually born sicker than they were than generations past. And I always, in my practice, when I have a client who's new to this, always draw a parallel with what goes on in human medicine in terms of the incidence of asthma and juvenile diabetes and autism. And these things, you know, weren't like we weren't seeing them back in the 1970s when I was growing up. They just didn't exist.
Correct. I agree with you. What common diseases and disorders do you see so much of today versus 40 years ago? And I think you did touch on that a little bit, especially with the humans. I don't remember ever hearing the word autism when I was growing up. And how many of us are allergic to things now? And so are dogs. I don't think I meet too many dogs today that don't have allergies.
Right. Well, the term allergy is a great, you know, I kind of can look at that and broaden that into a more holistic perspective. But all of these disorders that we're seeing in dogs and cats today, most of them, have as their basis what's called an autoimmune or a mistunement in the immune system's response. So, for example, allergies is the definition technically is an overreaction, an immune reaction to either airborne or food allergens or flea bites or whatever you're talking about. And so you look at situations like that, that's the immune system attacking the body's own self rather than attacking the appropriate viruses and bacteria that are, you know, that we're always exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at deeper diseases, Rini, like, for example, diabetes and different hormonal diseases like thyroid problems and even certain brain behavioral disorders, a lot of them have the immune system as their basis. The immune system, for example, with diabetes, destroys the cells that produce insulin. Therefore, when you diagnose diabetes, we say, okay, that's where your body doesn't produce insulin. But what caused it is actually the immune system destroying the body's own innate ability to produce insulin.
Mm-hmm.
Same with cancer. Cancer is, all of us have cancer cells that are reproducing, that are always occurring all the time in our bodies, but we have parts of our immune system called natural killer cells that keep those cancer cells in check. But if we, again, bombard the immune system with too many viral vaccines, again, poor diets, potentially toxic pesticides, eventually you get the immune system breaking down, and then that leads to these diseases, and some of them that I'll, you know, just mention briefly, thyroid disorders, seizures, again, allergies, cancer, dogs and cats with chronic digestive problems, and diseases known as inflammatory bowel disease, and you know, the list goes on, but all of them have a central theme of the immune system being, you know, dysregulated.
It seems like lately, like for the last year or so, when I go to work with a client's dog, there's always some kind of problem, medical problem with the dog anymore. Digestive problems, I see it almost every day. I have it in my own dog.
Right.
You mentioned cancer cells, that we all have cancer cells in our body. Are we born with those cells, or are we prone to having those cells develop in our body because of our environment?
Well, I think the latter. I think the answer to your question is probably both of those. I mentioned earlier that we now have proof that viruses are now, and even in the form of vaccines, can actually induce genetic changes in our DNA that can predispose to cancer. So when people say something has a genetic cause, sometimes environmental factors, for example, vaccines and pesticides, can be the cause of those genetic changes that we then pass on to generations. But that being said, as just a, you know, the groundwork to start in a lot of animals, you know, being in a polluted modern 21st century world where we're exposed to pollutants and you know, poor water and poor, you know, food supplies and all of that, which we all are, yes, our bodies are constantly being bombarded by toxins and stressors, emotional and physical, that sometimes do turn on these genes, and then we get cancer cells to start to produce, and this is a, you know, kind of a known fact. But a healthy immune system has parts of it that keeps those cancer cells in check. So yes, every day, you know, we have cells that are trying to proliferate, overgrow, but then a healthy immune system keeps that in check. Yes.
Well, this is fascinating. So I'm personally interested in your answers to the following questions, because I work with an awful lot of puppies. What advice do you give your own clients about vaccinations for puppies?
Well, with vaccinations, and with my own children, that to me is an individual decision. It's a big discussion. I give lectures on it that can last hours, you know, when I travel and I do different seminars. But I will tell you that I kind of give information to clients and let them make an informed decision. In terms of vaccinations, to summarize, I'm more of a minimalist when it comes to vaccinations. There are certain core viruses that certainly animal guardians should consider. I will say that most veterinarians out there, and all of them are well-meaning, but again, we're not taught about this in veterinary school, but most veterinarians out there are tremendously over-vaccinating, especially puppies with multiple viruses, sometimes 5, 7, and 9 different viruses in various combinations. You know, sometimes when a client brings an animal to the doctor and they get one shot, there's like 7 viruses in that one shot.
Right, right.
So when I advise clients, if they're going to vaccinate their puppies, and certainly rabies is a legal requirement in healthy animals, I should say, but rabies is a legal requirement. But other than rabies, what I typically do if a client decides on vaccinations is to do what are known as mono or bivalent vaccinations. So in other words, just using one viral component at a time. And several experts in the field, from Dr. Gene Dodds, who used to be on staff at Penn, and Ron Schultz, who's considered by many to be the leading expert on vaccinology in the country, talk about spreading out vaccinations or giving just one or two at a time. And so the two that I would typically have clients consider, and again, I weigh the pros and cons with each client and let them make the ultimate decision, is parvo and distemper. The rest of them, to me, either have no role in vaccination programs, haven't been proven safe, or are not necessary in those mumbo-jumbo, as Dr. Dodd likes to call them, cocktails that are given to animals every 2 to 3 weeks, and sometimes even every week before you even have a chance to pick up your puppy.
Right.
And then the immune system's already been, you know, potentially damaged for a lifetime. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's a real important decision for guardians to make when it comes to, you know, deciding which, if any, vaccinations to use. And, you know, again, how often they should be given, because we're finding now the immunity to most of these things also is a lifetime. So, for example, a dog gets a parvo vaccine at 16 weeks of age. That immunity, Dr. Schultz has been quoted as saying, lasts years, if not the life of the animal. So why are pets getting shots every 1 and even every 3 years, as, you know, a lot of veterinarians, you know, still
mm-hmm.
do?
Mm-hmm. What about the vaccinations if dogs are going to be kenneled, or if they go to dog parks or doggy daycares, and even puppy classes? Do you think that those dogs should have anything differently done to them or with them because they're going to be in group situations with other dogs?
The types of infectious diseases that you would see at like a daycare, whether it be human daycare or doggy daycare, are upper respiratory, you know, airway sort of viruses or bacteria. Unfortunately, Dr. Schultz, who I have all referred to, as I said, the leading expert on vaccinology in the country, you know, respected that way by all of the conventional community, has talked about kennel cough not being a vaccinatable disease. So, in other words, when you have an airway disease in dogs, it's much more important that what the factors that lead to, let's say, kennel cough are more involved with stress and crowding rather than actually, you know, due to the bacteria or viruses themselves. So, for example, Bordetella, which is part of the kennel cough vaccine complex, is actually a normal inhabitant of a dog's airways. It overgrows when they're stressed or they're in a crowded or, you know, high volume circumstance. So I personally find that, you know, Bordetella and kennel cough vaccinations, if anything, actually not only just suppress immune systems, but, you know, don't protect against kennel cough. In fact, I see as much, if not more, kennel cough in vaccinated dogs than I do in non-vaccinated dogs.
I think one of the arguments for giving a Bordetella vaccine that I've heard is if the dog is to contract kennel cough or an upper respiratory ailment, that having the vaccine will, or let's say may, help the animal have a lesser severe case of it. Is that a misnomer?
Yes, it is. In fact, I'll never forget at the practice I'm currently working out of, doing some conventional work part-time, I'll never forget an angry client just coming in, and actually he had to board his dog right away, and so one of the more effective, quote-unquote effective, ways to supposedly deliver that vaccine is through the nose, because you're giving it directly into the airways.
Right.
So this was a dog, and you get supposedly quicker immunity that way and protection, you know, right where the viruses and bacteria, what we call, replicate. But this gentleman, we gave the vaccine, and the dog went home, and he just had to board this one dog for the day. He actually had 5 dogs at home.
Mm-hmm.
So this one dog went into the kennel that day, came out with kennel cough.
Wow.
Probably from the vaccine, because it takes days for viruses and bacteria to overgrow. It just doesn't, you know, happen right away. So this obviously came from the modified live viruses and bacteria in the intranasal vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
But not only did this one dog get it, but he came in irate because he said, I example, my one dog in for just one day of boarding, and then when I took him home, every dog in the house had kennel cough, and they weren't even boarded.
Really?
So, in other words, this dog, the dog that was vaccinated, not only with the modified live virus, not only came down with the virus, with the disease right away, mm-hmm. but also spread it to other animals in the house within a day or two.
Wow.
Hadn't even been boarded.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying by this whole idea of protecting animals against these, you know, really stress-induced diseases. The science isn't there to show that it actually protects or lessens the infection rate.
Now, what about the different strains of these diseases? I mean, so if an animal got a Bordetella vaccine, aren't there different strains of kennel cough?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, Bordetella is one bacteria, but there are also different viruses, like what's called parainfluenza, and other viruses that are involved with certainly, you know, upper respiratory symptoms, just like there are in people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, different cold viruses, you know, there's not just flu.
Mm-hmm.
There are other viruses. So, you know, the vaccine doesn't even have those other viruses in there.
Okay.
Then if you use the argument, well, I won't use the modified live intranasal, but I'll use an injectable form, you know, the Bordetella injectable, well, that vaccine also has been shown to offer the studies have shown that vaccine offers zero to little protection, and you also get the heavy doses of mercury and adjuvants that I haven't mentioned that come along with injectable vaccines in the Bordetella injectable vaccine.
Is that right?
So to me, I would, you know, try and not use those vaccines if possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm sure that there's a canine flu now that seems to be going around, and you did touch on the flu, and everybody's up in arms about it. Everybody's worried to death. I know that several daycares have already closed for a couple of weeks because there was an outbreak of the canine flu. How bad is this flu, and what is your opinion about the vaccines, if any, that should or should not be used?
Let's start back with where the canine flu came from. And again, this is accepted fact, and again, just information I'm presenting all has come from, you know, lectures I've been to by Dr. Schultz and from the literature. Canine flu actually started, I think it was back in the late 90s, there was an isolated outbreak in a group of greyhounds down in Florida that were housed next to an equine racetrack. And at the horses races, horses are tremendously over-vaccinated. And one of the vaccines horses get is actually called equine influenza. And it was believed, and it was shown actually, that, and greyhounds, of course, are under a tremendous immune stress. I mean, they're raced. I mean, everybody knows about
right. All
the horrors of greyhound
racing. Horrible.
Everything they go through. But they were, you know, so these greyhounds being housed, they were actually housed on the same property, same premises that these horses were. And what's believed to have started the canine flu is the crossing of species lines of the equine flu virus. In other words, by vaccinating these horses into these crowded, stressed conditions, and racehorses certainly fall like right under the bill of what greyhounds are, you know, experience, that this virus, the influenza virus, and this goes for people, influenza viruses too, these viruses have a tremendous capacity to what's called mutate, and that means they change. And they adapt. And by over-vaccinating these horses, these viruses actually crossed over into the dog population at that same racetrack, which, of course, took advantage of the weak greyhounds whose immune systems are far from strong, you know, innately because of, you know, what they go through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the disease actually started, by over-vaccinating horses in crowded, stressful circumstances. And so you see, again, the idea that, you know, these viral upper respiratory conditions are actually due to crowding and stress or poor hygiene, let's say, any infectious disease, in fact, and that vaccinations, if anything, actually sometimes cause the problem that you're actually trying to prevent. So as we give more and more vaccines, we actually weaken, ultimately, the population as a whole's immune system and make them sometimes even more prone to the condition you're trying to prevent. I mean, the same is true with human influenza. I mean, every year I hear, well, we didn't get it right this year. We got the wrong strain, and this and that and the other thing. So I personally think, and to go back, I mean, even to parvovirus, there is data that show that canine parvovirus actually showed up as a mutation of the kitty parvovirus, which was being given to cats in the droves back in the 70s. And
mm-hmm.
then, again, it crossed species lines and then affected the dog. So the answer is not more vaccines. Now, this specific vaccine, the canine influenza vaccine, is actually a client's guardian should know. It has not been studied for safety, long-term safety or efficacy. It's what's called a conditional vaccine by the FDA. I use the term conditional in quotes. So, in other words, it's not an approved vaccine. And it's a great example of how what I hear in the media with the commercials and clients calling and asking is the use of fear in getting clients to use a conditional, non-proven vaccine and trying to prevent a disease that actually we probably, you know, that we certainly caused in the first place. And if anything, if it's spreading, we have our own selves to blame for it, in my opinion.
Wow, this is something else. And even with the swine flu, I mean, that's a new vaccine, isn't it? And everybody's jumping on the bandwagon to get it. I haven't gotten it, and you know, I just don't really think I feel comfortable getting it because it's not been proven. And so many things in medicine and even science, they'll tell you 1 year everything's fine, it's great. And then 3 or 5 years down the road, they're telling you that, oh, my God, these people are dying off because they've developed this disease and that disease, and then they'll blame the vaccine for it, or they'll blame something else that they told you to get.
Well, the swine flu vaccine is a great example because, you know, before this winter season, if you remember, oh, we're going to have a pandemic, you saw the news every day, Sanjay Gupta on CNN, you know, you got to go get your swine flu shot, on and on and on it goes. And the thing you have to realize is that, you know, the southern hemisphere, like places like Australia, they already went through their winter last year with swine flu, and nobody was dying in droves. There were certain people that were affected, but most of the population did fine, and it wasn't this, you know, death, you know, sweeping pandemic that the media would have you believe. And the sad thing about a lot of this, Rini, is unfortunately it's driven by drug companies and a lot of money to, you know, to promote these vaccines that in many cases are either not shown to be safe, mm-hmm. effective, or contain components that might even contribute to disease, like mercury and aluminum and different metals that are the preservatives of the adjuvants in some of these vaccines that people don't realize have been shown to cause disease of the brain, of the immune system. I mean, that's why with pregnant women, they started telling people and pregnant women not to eat tuna. You know, that was something for years, you know, nobody ever thought about eating tuna fish, but because of the high mercury levels in tuna, pregnant women are not supposed to eat tuna. But why the heck would we want to be vaccinating pregnant women with mercury-filled vaccines? It makes absolutely no sense, does it?
No, it doesn't.
So
you're so right.
It's all in the name of the buck, to be honest with you.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a question, and this is a question very close to my heart. Now, I'm praying to God that you agree with me, because if you don't, I think I'm going to cry. I train a lot of puppies, and you've sent me many, many puppies to come to my classes and to train. And there is a definite problem with socialization with puppies must begin at 3 weeks, and that period of socialization ends at 12 weeks. And then we're doing remedial work. We have a lot of fearful puppies out there whose vet tells them not to take the dog anywhere, to keep the dog in the backyard, and then until the dog has had its first set or last set of shots, which normally doesn't happen until it's 16 weeks old. So now we have a puppy who has had insufficient socialization, now is showing definite fear behaviors. What do we do? What is your opinion here about having puppies come into a clean group environment where things are kept clean and monitored, or taking the dog for a walk on clean surfaces without having all of the vaccines that vets are recommending today?
I will tell you, Rini, again, and to answer it you highlight perfectly the difference between holistic and, again, traditional conventional medicine. Basically, what you're saying that most of the conventional vets are out there are saying, there's this virus is out there, they're going to get your dog, therefore don't walk it, don't do this, don't do that. It's all based upon fear-based living.
Definitely.
In other words, the reliance on drugs, you need to take this drug, this vaccine, otherwise your dog's going to get sick. In my experience, and that goes over almost 20 years, animals basically, they do fine. Parvo out in the population is a rare oddity, to be honest with you.
Yes.
So, you know, getting that puppy socialized early to me is much more important. I agree with you on that one.
Thank you.
In fact, most of the parvo cases I see are in dogs that are in crowded puppy pet stores or that are just been bombarded with a gazillion viral vaccines, and then they come down with what they're vaccinated, you know, with parvo in a very, you know, stressful circumstance. But from a holistic perspective, you have a dog who's in a loving home, getting fed a nutrient appropriate diet, which of course we won't have time to get into on this interview, but an appropriate diet, not being overstressed, that puppy should be at getting socialized, just like our children should be out there getting socialized at a certain age.
Right.
So I agree totally with you, and it really does highlight the difference between a more holistic approach to health, which is where, you know, the body can be healthier, you can go out and enjoy life, and these viruses and bugs aren't going to get you,
mm-hmm.
versus, you know, don't leave the yard until your animal gets this last shot, because if you do, you're increasing this, you know, tremendous likelihood of parvo. And I can say that, you know, I haven't seen one case in my clientele of parvo that way in the many years of my practice. So I'm all for early socialization.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you so much for all this wonderful information you've given us today. And you have to promise me that you're going to do this with me again.
Oh, I would love to.
Good, good. Well, I know you're a busy man, and I'm going to let you go. And I thank you again so much for giving us all this wonderful information, and we'll talk again soon.
You're very welcome. Anything I can ever do to just give information to the animal guardian public, and it just that's what makes my career and work so passionate. I'm so passionate about.
Yeah, you and me both. Have
okay.
a great day.
Take care, Renee.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in this morning to Thursday in the Doghouse. Please tune in again next week. Our topic of discussion next week will be the sport of agility and how that can be hugely beneficial to your dog. It's a nice day. Take your dog out for a walk today, and we'll see you next week.